You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, June 18th, 2020. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. We're broadcasting multiple different kinds of steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Professor Gene Bajlan joins us. We're talking about right-wing authoritarian governments, conspiracy theories, and the repression of protests. We're making the comparison between the Republican Party, the GOP, and Turkey's AKP government. This goes back to an article we co-wrote for the Jacobin a couple years ago and has renewed relevance today with ongoing democratic Black Lives Matter uprisings across the United States. Also, Israel, after being an informal, not officially stated apartheid state for decades, is moving to annexation to the West Bank, the new coalition government. We'll talk about that. Also, John Bolton, world historic monster, embarrassingly being welcomed to the resistance. But we will talk about him, some of the gossip in his new book. Guess what? Donald Trump is an absolute relentless mega scumbag, but John Bolton is also bothered by him because at times he wanted to practice diplomacy instead of relentlessly warmonger against Iran and North Korea as Bolton wanted. All that, but Gene Bajlan, jobless claims another 1.5 million as the Trump quote-unquote recovery hits a snag. Even as unemployment continues to accelerate, the Trump administration wants to get rid of unemployment benefits and have a back-to-work bonus. Atlantic police are calling in sick after the officer that murdered Rashard Brooks is charged with murder. Now, is this going to be like New York City several years ago, where through the non-enforcement of broken windows and other harassment-based policing, are they going to sort of prove themselves out of a lot of their tasks? We shall see. Florida, Arizona, and Texas set records for new COVID-19 cases. And of course, no lockdown, no real response is going to happen. Oklahoma's governor is asking Donald Trump to not repeat Ronald Reagan and to not visit the site of a genocidal attack by whites in a historically black district in Tulsa. Apparently, Trump encouraged Xi's vicious human rights abuses of the Uyghurs and begged for help with his re-election campaign. Wants the Justice Department to charge John Bolton. India cautions China, they say, against their exaggerated and untenable claims. Well, this dispute in the border region between India and China goes back to 1962 when they fought a war. Accelerating now, Pakistan says four civilians were killed by Indian forces on its border. And close aide to Bolsonaro arrested, one connected to the Rio de Janeiro paramilitaries. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. How's the connection, guys? How are we doing?
Well, I'm doing well. I don't know how about my connection, though.
All right.
Not bad, Matt. That wasn't bad. I gotta say.
Not wasn't bad. Good stuff. I guess it's always the sort of start where there's a problem, and then we get flying. Protests are, of course, ongoing across the country. Donald Trump put out these, you know, ridiculous executive orders, the notion of banning a chokehold unless an officer feels their life is at risk. Clearly, a major part of this problem among many is that they often feel, maybe always feel, their life is at risk. And the physiology of claiming that your life could be at risk when you have that, just the capacity to have somebody else in a chokehold, you're already out of danger, at least in that moment. So the Democrats have put forward some new modest reforms to not get to restructuring, redistributing resources, reimagining public safety. And of course, the Republicans have put out, you know, what you'd expect, basically anemic and insulting bill in the Senate. Meanwhile, footage from these demonstrations across the country keep pouring in. I don't know when this was from, but this is extraordinary. And I realize this is a short clip, so we'll do clips 6 and 7. But everybody should watch this. Everybody should share this. If you're in Louisville, you should be getting this in you know, in front of every elected official possible. This basically shows.
I just want to say this is Twitter user Kentucky Kenji, and this is at a BLM protest earlier this week. Last week.
So this is a BLM protest in Kentucky last week. Somebody is in their window filming above the street, and they're basically filming some police cornering, dogpiling, starting to beat a protester. Watch what happens.
Oh shit, they shot at me. What the fuck?
They shot at me. What the F? Let's watch that again. I mean, this is something you can use. I mean, this isn't even, we've been seeing cops shooting at journalists, you know, being brazen enough to fire rubber bullets at reporters and everything else. This is just a guy in his window. I mean, again, just let the absolute criminality and brazenness of this sink in. It's over. They've got a guy. They're starting to beat him. Pop.
Oh, shit. They shot at me. What the fuck?
So apparently he's 33-year-old security guard, a patrol in Louisville's Hall of Justice. So he's security guard inside the Hall of Justice. Decided to start filming the cops, and they shot a smoke bang or something at the window.
They shot a smoke bang at the window. It's unbelievable.
That's like, that's what you would imagine coming from a war zone, basically, is someone trying to document something being torn up by a soldier.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So everybody needs to see that. And that is very illustrative right there. Matt Gaetz is, you know, no surprise to anybody watching this, is a scumbag and a rich kid and, you know, has all sorts of, you know, is the sort of prototype of the young Trump Republicans. And it's just, it's incredible watching this stuff unfold because, again, there's one part that, you know, someone like Lester Spence, Cedric Johnson, Adolph Reed, connecting, and the protests themselves, connecting Black Lives Matter to a whole matrix of issues in terms of core race, class, structure in this society, and also really the fact that we've consigned and decided we're going to build in a structured underclass, an excluded proletariat of tens of millions of people in this society, and we're going to have a absolutely hyped up militarized police, which are still doing what was called broken windows. They're still patrolling and terrorizing poor working black and brown communities to make way for gentrification, for, you know, as in Ferguson being the kind of quintessential example of just collecting fines, terrorizing physically and economically to, you know, basically subsidize the tax base of the wealthy part of town. And the courage and necessity of these protests are opening up a line of inquiry and a serious political discussion about most of the kind of core issues in our society. And we still have, and we'll probably sadly increasingly have with the, you know, vicious white identity politics of the Republican Party, this same just disgusting inability to recognize the basic reality that Black Lives Matter points to. And, you know, I saw somebody, these, you know, some racist right-wing trolls were sharing videos at the beginning of these protests of a couple of very vicious police murders that involved white people. And, you know, someone very astutely pointed out basically like, sure, so you should be on the streets too. You're showing us snuff films to deny racism and policing and to tamp down this discussion when you've actually shown some extraordinarily disturbing stuff, and you should also be out making demands about fundamental changes in policing. But of course, you know, we're not getting that. Matt Gaetz is an absolute scumbag. And this is basically, we saw Steven Crowder trying to goad and trying to terrorize with the police that artist yesterday. And basically here's a sort of congressional version of Crowder and Congressman Cedric Richmond dealing with him in the House.
I'm not interested in studying Antifa. I'm not even interested in studying the Klan or sovereign citizens right now, because that is not the imminent threat that black men face on a daily basis. And right now, too often, it is law enforcement. Those who were sworn to protect and to serve. And so all we're asking today is to deal with that. I don't mind dealing with other pieces of legislation. I don't mind dealing with other issues that you all may have. And what I don't want to leave this conversation with, and why I'm speaking now instead of later, is because I don't want you all to leave here saying, well, we didn't know. We didn't know that's how you felt, Cedric. I want it to be crystal clear, and I will give you the benefit of the doubt that it is an unconscious bias that I'm hearing, because at worst it's conscious bias, and that I would hate to assume from any of the people on the other side.
Will the gentleman yield?
Sure.
I appreciate your passion. Are you suggesting that you're certain that none of us have non-white children? Because you reflected on your black son and you said none of us could understand.
Matt, stop.
Right. We're going to go into this. And Matt Gaetz is just such an absolute scumbag. But I really, the precision and focus of Cedric Richmond, right? Like, no. Not only are we not going to do this Antifa bullshit that you assholes pull out all the time, we're not even going to talk about the Klan's terrorism right now. We're not even going to talk about these other, you know, these grotesque white supremacy based groups, because the fundamental threat is the literal state apparatus engaging in racist murder, engaging in discriminatory and brutal policing. He keeps it very focused. And now, of course, Matt Gaetz is going to show you the Crowder mindset, and it will be just as disgusting and as revealing as you'd expect.
have non-white children? Because you reflected on your black son and you said none of us could understand.
Matt, stop. I'm not about to get sidetracked about the color of our children. We're talking about black kids. I reclaimed my time.
You said that
I reclaimed my time. I know.
You want the discussion?
I know that
the gentleman reclaimed his time.
I said I reclaimed my time. I already know that there are people on the other side that have black grandchildren. It is not about the color of your kids. It is about black males, black people in the streets that are getting killed. And if one of them happens to be your kid, I'm concerned about him too. And clearly I'm more concerned about him than you are. Mm-hmm. So let's be clear about that.
You're claiming you're more concerned for my family than I do? Who in the hell do you are?
Gentlemen,
if the shoe fits. Listen,
you don't know how much we care about our families.
Kick dog holler.
You should take those words down. I care about your family and love your family.
The gentleman will suspend. The time belongs to the gentleman from Louisiana.
Cedric, would you yield?
Was that a nerve?
Yeah.
Oh, man, he hit that cry bully. That was beautiful. And always, I mean, my God, it is so whiny and pathetic and sinister with this children in my family. I mean, you don't remember when Mark Meadows, who's now the White House chief of staff, I think Congressman Meadows, he literally had a crying hissy fit because of a comment that Rashida Tlaib made. Congresswoman Tlaib made. I don't remember what it was. I don't even remember. I mean, the comment was not much, but the tantrum was a 2-day news cycle down to like poor, the late great Elijah Cummings. You know, we're friends, right? Matt Gaetz is disgusting and embarrassing. You should watch that. And it's never. Yeah, it's just endless obfuscation. And, you know, the idea, because you see in the Senate, you know, like McConnell and even the White House wants its own narrative on police brutality because, in fact, the protests are polling well. But remind yourselves of what the core attitudes and mindsets are here. And that's Matt Gaetz. All right, folks, do we have Gene, guys?
Yeah, we do here.
Okay.
Moment to transition into from the waiting room. All right.
Hello?
Gene, we need your video. Hello. Ironically, that is you in the MR studio. That's your picture.
Let me just get that video rolling.
Joining us now as he gets his video rolling is, there you go, it's Professor Gene Bajlan. He's a professor of history at Missouri State University and regular on various media, including, of course, TMBS, the Majority Report, and writes articles for numerous publications, including Jacobin. Gene, thanks so much for joining us. How are you? How is everybody? Hopefully staying safe.
Yeah, I'm doing well. I hope you're staying safe. And things in New York look like they've been pretty severe. Things in Springfield are picking up at the moment. People seem to have an opposition to wearing masks around here. But you know,
what's going on?
Yeah, people get very concerned about you submitting to tyrannical government power if you wear a mask here. But in general, we're staying very safe. Me and the little baby. Taking opportunities to spend more time with each other since I don't have to be in the office so much anymore.
Oh, that's cool. So, you know, let's start with just a kind of interesting comparison. And I think it's worth revisiting because the parallels have gotten, you know, even more intensified. But we wrote a piece a while ago, a couple years ago, comparing Turkey's Erdogan government and the AKP party and the Modern Republican Party in terms of this synergy between this deep conspiratorial mindset that goes to the highest reaches of government and actual, you know, in primarily the United States, we focus on legislative action across the country from Arizona to South Dakota to Washington State to really essentially make protesting and certainly, you know, nonviolent civil disobedience, illegal, something you could be held, turn someone to financial ruin, potentially allowing people. I mean, and we've seen the past several weeks, these, you know, horrifying car attacks that people have done driving into protesters across the United States. And I, you know, especially in light of Bolton's book, and we'll get to Bolton later, and you will never catch us praising John Bolton for a split second, but he does write a bit about, has some gossip among other things about the Trump-Erdogan relationship. I wanted to kind of revisit that. So can you sort of map out some of the parallels there for us?
Yeah, I think the piece that we wrote in 2017, unfortunately, has held up pretty well, as the Trump administration has progressed. I mean, I think, obviously sometimes comparisons between different countries can be quite trite and superficial, but I do think there are some significant comparisons to be made, especially in terms of the way that the Trump administration and the Erdogan administration sort of envisaged themselves, the way that despite holding the levers of power, they still present themselves as some kind of embattled minority. I mean, in the United States, the term deep state, for example, has become common currency especially amongst the political right. Now, the concept itself of a deep state is actually a perfectly reasonable concept, but the way that is obviously mobilized on the political right in the United States is in this conspiratorial manner, these sort of cabals behind the scenes. Now, this terminology, deep state, although there are precedents to it across the world, comes from Turkey. There's a concept known as the derin devlet, which is the deep state, which referred to the relationships between far right groups, mafia groups, groups within the military, and particularly became relevant during the conflict with the PKK in Turkey's Kurdish areas as well. And so, this concept, birthed numerous conspiracy theories. So, the AKP often sort of, especially early on during its reign, pitched itself as being against this deep state cabal. And, we're seeing a similar kind of discourse in the United States. Erdogan repeats conspiracy theories about plots to undermine Turkey, both from within and without. More recently, we've sort of seen a focus in Turkey towards looking at, anyone who opposes him is a follower of Fethullah Gulen, who is this religious leader who lives in Pennsylvania and who was once an ally of Erdogan and who, helped Erdogan attack some of those entrenched interests within the Turkish state. But later, there was a conflict between those two and he became public enemy number one. So, we see this sort of conspiratorial politics, going on in Turkey and sort of metamorphosizing, over time, different enemies appear. But the core element is that there is a conspiracy. The Trump administration, we see a similar thing. We see an ongoing sort of attempt to present the Donald Trump as this embattled figure who is fighting against these secretive cabals. I mean, just look at the popularity of the QAnon phenomena in the United States. It's an absolutely barking mad conspiracy theory, yet it holds an enormous amount of currency. You go to Turkey, amongst AKP supporters, and not only supporters of AKP, but generally within the broader population, there are enormous amount of conspiracy theories about various groups, the Catholic Church, the Freemasons, the Israeli lobby. These are all conspiring to undermine Erdogan and stop Turkey becoming a great power. Just as in the United States, we have all the Trump administration and followers of Donald Trump are always trying to present these internal and external threats as working to undermine the Trump administration. often as a way to explain away the incompetence or the political mistakes made by the regime. So when something bad happens, it's not because of a bad policy. It's because somebody behind the scenes has been pulling the strings. You know, George Soros is, you know, a common boogeyman on the American right. And also in Turkey, you know, in Turkey, George Soros has long been seen as this pernicious individual who seeks to undermine the country. So we see these kind of overlaps in this conspiratorial style of politics.
And in actual, you know, legislative action, I think that that's really important to highlight.
Yeah, I think definitely when we look at the way that the Trump administration has been, and more broadly, I mean, I think this was...
Yeah, the Republican Party.
The Republican Party. It's very easy to pick on Trump because he's uncouth and he's not, you know, he doesn't conform to what we are used to as a politician. And, you know, in some ways, comparing him with Erdogan is a little bit unfair because Erdogan has some kind of basic competence in,
right,
in managing politics. But, you know, the Republican Party in general has, and we've seen this as a, you know, has been trying to make it more difficult for people to protest. In Turkey as well, you know, we see the government, I mean, just recently there was, in response to the arrest of some members of the HDP, the pro-Kurdish left-wing party in Turkey, there was an attempt to organize a protest. And, you know, that protest was banned by the Turkish authorities on various grounds, including, you know, a public health grounds that COVID-19 was going to make would be dangerous. So we see the sort of cynical use of bureaucratic measures to make protests more difficult. We see the extensive use of police violence. Now, of course, police violence in Turkey is, you know, so much more overt than in the United States. But, you know, we're
seeing... Oh, if you're watching the opening package of today's show, it gets more and more overt by the day.
Exactly.
In the United States. And, of course, for specific targeted populations, it always has been in the United States. But do you think, actually, the thing that gets complicated, though, is... So on one hand, too, you know, of course, and maybe there's an awkward parallel here as well, but... you know, Joe Biden, as an example, is interested in sort of, you know, implementing kind of like federal terrorism guidelines, which would actually have made, as an example, Trump's huffing and puffing about Antifa infinitely more dangerous if that bill, you know, that Biden had put forward was on the books. Bill Clinton signed the Effectiveness and Death Penalty Act in the mid-1990s. So, you know, again, it's another one of these conversations where it's absolutely both sides and it is a bipartisan effort. Now, the Republicans are undeniably at more extremes and, you know, drawing kind of facile, pure parallels is silly and we reject that. But there is a systems problem in place. And also related to that, even the discourse, as you pointed out, and maybe you could elaborate, deep state is a very valid conceptual frame, certainly in Turkey. I would say definitely also in the United States, if you consider everything from a permanent lobbying class to absolutely a military industrial intelligence complex that absolutely runs U.S. foreign policy in a bipartisan fashion. There's no question about it, and does have permanent governing interests. So in the discourse, I've noticed, you know, especially in that with the advent of the sort of like right wing kind of mainstreaming of weaponized conspiracy theory culture, it's always been there, you know, Alex Jones, Rush Limbaugh, whatever, but now in Fox News, but you know, it was, you know, George W. Bush was lying about WMDs, but he wasn't saying, you know, the reason the WMDs aren't there is because there's, you know, an NSA cabal with, you know, like Oprah and George Soros that is trying to embarrass me or something, right? And so the response of the kind of resistance types has been, well, let's discount, you know, let's just, you know, just the facts, ma'am. And that has actually turned into a completely craven and you know, ridiculous belief and trust in, you know, the military and the intelligence apparatus. We'll get to John Bolton later. Anytime, you know, any thug steps out and says the obvious about Donald Trump, they're hailed as a hero. So maybe we can kind of conflate these two questions, but how do we strike the critical balance while we track the changes that have happened in Trump's America or Erdogan's Turkey, but then not just sort of revert to a kind of ridiculous, like, you know, the governing institutions are just fine. There isn't structural brutal corruption. The last thing I'll add is, you know, it's like, yes, I think there's no doubt. Obviously, we see that with, you know, the kind of embarrassment of so much of Russiagate. Of course, there were elements of the United States kind of permanent governing class that did not like Donald Trump. Now, the more substantive thing, though, to note is that he gave them substantively everything that they wanted in terms of, you know, no limits on drone strikes, you know, continuing with Democratic support to amp up the Patriot Act. Anyways, just how do we have this analysis and disaggregate the conspiracy theorizing and the repression and the unique danger of that as exemplified by these right-wing authoritarians while not going back to this very silly, deluded, dangerous, simplistic discourse on just kind of blind institutional trust?
Sure. I mean, I think you strike at a very important point there. I think one of the reasons that the right-wing critique and the right-wing narrative is so powerful is because it touches on an element of truth. You know, there is and there are, you know, deep interests in the United States. As you mentioned, you have the national security state, the lobbyists, you know, the civil service and so on. In Turkey, you had a military that basically up until the early 2000s had veto power over the Turkish government that could operate any type of sort of action that it wanted behind the scenes. You know, there was the, you know, coups nearly every 10 years and so on and so forth. So when that discourse about conspiracy comes into the mainstream, it resonates because people do see that there are there are elements of truth to it. I mean, I think in general, when we look at, you know, conservative politics, they're very good at weaponizing liberal hypocrisy. So, you know, there are entrenched interests, and, you know, liberals in response to Trump's criticism is not to say, well, you know, there is a point, but is to be completely partisan and just rage on about how bad Donald Trump is in a way to kind of, I guess, avoid broader structural critiques of the society. I mean, a good example of this, you mentioned how in the United States, some of the authoritarian shifts in American politics have been at least, you know, the Democratic Party has failed to really stand up to those shifts and at times has been complicit in those shifts. The same can be applied to Turkey. If we look at the main opposition party, the Republican People's Party, you know, one of the big shifts just before the 2016 coup attempt was to remove parliamentary immunity. Now, obviously, parliamentary immunity does mean that, you know, politicians in Turkey could get away with corruption. But it also acted as an important check in a system which is very majoritarian on the governing party banning the opposition. Now, when just before the coup, the AKP put forward laws stripping MPs of parliamentary immunity, a move directed at the HDP, the pro-Kurdish party, well, Republican People's Party signed on to that. And now that law is being used against them. So rather than sort of standing up to that authoritarianism, they buy into parts of the narrative and basically become nursemaids to this authoritarian shift. And this is one of the really important things to understand about the Democratic Party. It's all wonderful to be criticizing, you know, Trump's excessive use of violence, but if you're signing off on huge spending increases in the military or not putting a check on the Patriot Act, then what are you doing? You know, a lot of the stuff that opposition politicians do in the United States is performative. Like, for example, you know, we saw all the Democrats in the Congress wearing an African dress and taking a knee. I mean, this was ridiculous. It looked like there was some kind of, you know, School of Oriental and African Studies anthropology professor going to meet a Nigerian prince in the 1930s, you know, acting all ridiculously in that manner. So not doing their job and purely focusing on symbolic issues. Again, in Turkey, there was a lot of huffing and haring amongst the sort of traditional Kemalist right of the country, the nationalist, about symbols, complaining about, oh no, girls with headscarves are allowed to go to university now, focusing on those issues rather than, you know, paying attention to actual authoritarian shifts in governing policy. And it comes back to bite them because, you know, those laws that they sign off on, well, they're eventually going to be turned on them.
Two quick things before we get to the sort of formalization or the formalization of apartheid in Israel with the annexation. Tell us first, I want to remind everybody of the Flynn story, but first, can you talk about the HDP and the political prisoners and what the HDP represents?
Sure. So when we look at Turkish politics, the dominant political party for the last two decades almost has been the Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, which began as a kind of conservative party, but it has now increasingly become Erdogan's sort of personal vehicle. And then you had an opposition party, the Republican People's Party, which claims the mantle of Ataturk, which is nominally on the left, but is more nationalistic. Now, in recent years, we've seen the rise of the HDP, which comes out of sort of the parliamentary wing of the Kurdish movement. But what has happened over the last couple of years, it's endeavored to move away from being a purely sort of Kurdish interest party to being a broader social democratic party under the leadership of Selahattin Demirtas and Figen Yüksekdağ. The party and Figen Yüksekdağ is Turkish, not Kurdish. The party has sort of moved to being more of a Syriza or a Corbynite Labour or something like that, and has sought to sort of build an intersectional politics which brings together not only Kurds but labour movements, LGBTQ movements, you know, other sort of soft left groups and things like that. And in 2015, they had an enormous success in the election because they scored over 10% of the national vote, which allowed them to enter parliament as directly. There's a very complicated discussion we don't need to get into about electoral politics in Turkey, but this was a big win, and this undermined the AKP. So what we've seen since 2015 is a ramping up of the conflict with the Kurds, both inside Turkey, where we've seen the progressive sort of removal of Kurdish mayors in the predominantly Kurdish regions of Turkey, the arrest of Demirtas, who's in prison, and on a sort of ongoing campaign, which continues to this day, of arresting AKP members, while at the same time trying to sort of ramp up conflict with the Kurds to sort of exacerbate that conflict, not only repressing Kurds within Turkey, but launching attacks over in international borders. In the 90s, Turkey launched over operations against the Kurdistan Workers Party in Iraq. That's not a new thing. But that was done by the military with a kind of national security logic. The AKP now is launching these attacks, not so much with a national security logic, but with a political propaganda logic to drive a wedge between the HDP and other members of the Turkish opposition, and to hopefully, when the new elections come, to drive the HDP down below the 10% electoral threshold and ensure that AKP picks up those seats in the southeast to consolidate its position. So right now, Turkey is launching a very bloody attack into Iraq, attacking Yazidi villages, you know, killing people. They recently killed an Iraqi Kurdish off-duty officer, you know. And this is not because they believe they're going to wipe out the PKK, but because it provides that kind of ongoing nationalistic hostility that the AKP is sort of able to feed upon in order to sort of break the opposition apart.
Absolutely. And that's those political prisoners are definitely political prisoners that are very important to have solidarity with and awareness of. And there's a real significance to the HDP in the region and globally. Remind us of Michael Flynn's relationship to the Erdogan government and Fethullah Gulen.
Yeah, so Michael Flynn, and I don't know if people remember this, but you know, if you're a Turkey follower, you will remember this. On the day of the election of Donald Trump, The Hill published an article from Michael Flynn in which he basically regurgitated the Turkish government's line about Fethullah Gulen, this religious leader, saying that, you know, he's kind of terrorist and the United States should be involved in suppressing him and extraditing him. And, you know, there was a plot, for example, that Flynn and his son were apparently thinking about kidnapping Fethullah Gulen from his sort of compound in Pennsylvania and renditioning him to Turkey, you know, utterly bizarre and crazy stuff. But of course, Flynn was on the payroll of the Turkish government. I mean, we have, you know, the Turkish government has been chucking around money in Washington. You know, people focus on Russia. And I think the lesson from Russia is not so much like there's this evil sort of conspiracy theory, but it's like, if you have a political system where, you know, you can just deploy unlimited money, don't be surprised if foreign money is going to turn up and start trying to do the same thing as domestic lobby groups do. And Turkey is one of those countries. Not only Flynn was having close relations with Turkey, but Rudy Giuliani had close relations with Turkey. Turkey hired a lobbying group with close ties to the Trump administration. And Turkey actually produces propaganda directly for the consumption of Donald Trump. One of the recent things they've done, TRT World.
I shouldn't laugh. I'm sorry.
Published a video saying how the Kurds in Syria were working with Antifa and training Antifa fighters to return back to the United States and overthrow the American government. It's utterly—
and Glenn Beck ran with this. We played it yesterday.
Oh, Glenn Beck ran with it? Yeah, well, mm-hmm. I'm not not surprised. So, you know, there's actually— Turkey has a lot of, has a lot of fingers in the administration. Flynn is only one part of the puzzle. I mean, so it's a very strange story that sort of reaches to the highest levels of the U.S. government, and obviously causes tension because within the conservative movement, you know, there is deep hostility in some quarters towards Turkey. I follow right-wing news quite a lot, and you know, you have people like Mark Levin, who's a total crazy, right? He's very anti-Erdogan, sees him as like some kind of Islamist. But there's this faction which is getting paid, which sort of buys into the Turkish narrative that actually Turkey is this country in the bulwark against sort of radicalism and radical leftism and things like that. So this is a really strange situation. And, you know, what Bolton's book is, and we'll come on to this, you know, Bolton talks about Trump's sort of affinity towards him and Trump's attempt to intervene in court cases that had implicated Turkey in particular crimes in the United States. I mean, one of the great ironies is, you know, there was a court case where a Turkish-Iranian gold trader and a Turkish bank, Halk Bank, were, you know, sanction bustings with Iran, right? And, you know, I'm not surprised Bolton brought this up because, of course, we all know Bolton is probably crying into his soup about not being able to massacre Iranians. But, you know, Trump missed the maximum pressure on Iran at the same time as telling Erdogan, don't worry, I'm going to handle this $20 billion sanction busting operation that Turkey was going on with as well, and attempting to use that as some kind of leverage within his relationship with Erdogan. I mean, and it seems Erdogan is pretty good at sort of, I don't like to get into sort of psychological understandings of politics too much, but
he knows how to play Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, he clearly does.
He knows how to, you know, like—
he alphas Trump.
He alphas Trump.
He definitely alphas Trump.
Trump is what, you know, Trump is just doesn't have the same sort of street thug politics of Erdogan.
Although Erdogan came from something, and Erdogan is a thug in the full use of that word. But first of all, not in a pretend, thug, and a very intelligent one, unfortunately, for the Turkish and Kurdish people in the main. But his capacity is right up there, interpersonally. And they all have different styles, but Modi's very good at it, as an example, in a completely different way. It's very interesting to watch, these right wing sort of authoritarian types, the Modis, the Putins, the Erdogans, who have actual political capacity. And then, of course, Trump, Trump feels comfortable, Boris Johnson's a jackass, and, Bolsonaro is just absolutely pathetic in his, elevation of Trump. And so Trump will unfollow him on Twitter as things go poorly for Bolsonaro, which is absolutely hysterical. And but when it comes to, the guys that have, and I should keep saying, unfortunately, she is an able operator, and Trump builds a whole brand on xenophobia and fear mongering, and then on the other hand, clearly is just sort of submitted to the guy. Anyways, and I really like your point too, that if you look at DC, there's nothing country specific. It's a completely absolutely rotted and corrupted system that is absolutely just washing in every type of influence money imaginable. And of course, we always say, Google, Amazon, Koch brothers, these are infinitely more structural and dangerous than any foreign government. But you can add, Russia, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Israel, the Emirates. These are all places that, can just, and countless more, endlessly wash the United States money. And of course, I didn't even mention, petro, arms, and pharma. But Gene, let's get to the Bolton book first. Then we'll get to Israel, because you brought it up. So can we just kind of dispatch of Bolton first, though? I think it's important. And again, I don't care about people's personally or, whatever. It's not about a grudge at Bolton because he's a jerk. It's the fact that in the process of the resistance embracing these types, of course, they're showing they have no policy commitments, don't care about anything besides Trump, but that, we're really forgetting that this guy is absolutely one of the most, just mad and insane foreign policy. Really one of the great warmongers, bloodthirsty of our time. So we'll get to some of the things he said. I think, obviously the part about encouraging the treatment of the Uyghurs is particularly disturbing, but remind us who John Bolton is. And maybe also, I'll shut up in a second, but some of his complaints about Donald Trump are, there's the usual, he's disgusting and corrupt, which we all kind of know. But then there's there's other times where Trump seems pretty sympathetic. Trump is like, hey, just let me talk to the North Koreans or the Iranians. And Bolton's like, see, this guy's really a wuss, just like the foreign policy establishment. He doesn't want to, potentially murder millions over some horrifying foreign policy vision.
Well, Bolton, I don't know. I guess I'm getting old now. But, Bolton was a big guy back in the days of the Bush administration, and a controversial guy. He was appointed UN ambassador, and he made that famous comment about, destroying one of the levels of the UN because he believed it's, useless. I'm paraphrasing, but it's something like that. He is definitely within this tradition, neoconservative tradition of foreign policy. He is a unilateralist. He does not have much time for multilateral behavior. He is a sort of very hawkish American imperialist in that context. He's been and he has a fixation with overturning the Iranian regime. Now, I would note here, I have no fondness for the Iranian regime. They're a brutal, violent regime that engages in, you know, repression at home, that murders, you know, minority groups, Kurds, Azeris, women, and so on and so forth. But Bolton, you know, he gets into bed with really nasty groups such as the Mujahideen Khalq, you know, possibly the only worse administration for Iran at the moment than the mullahs would be the Mujahideen Khalq, which is a sort of a cult, you know, a cult-like organization which has its tendrils into all kinds of politics, which, you know, cooperated with Saddam Hussein in the Iran-Iraq war, and so on and so forth. And Bolton is, you know, Bolton, and I, you know, believe this is purely cynical, you know, works with them because he believes them as a good sort of force that they could, that could be used to overturn the regime. So, you know,
lots of money though there too. I mean, just related back earlier, I mean, they've paid Rudy Giuliani, Howard Dean. So there's a lot of money to be made as well.
There is a lot of money to be made. You know, they operate in a, you know, they operate in a very sophisticated way, the Mujahideen. You know, they'll go around under fake names saying, hey, we're the Committee for Democracy in Iran. Do you like democracy in Iran? And, you know, no one's going to say no to that. But then you have these cynical people who know who they are. You know, John Bolton is not some sort of freshman who got duped into signing a petition of Mariam Rajavi as the sort of president-elect of Iran. You know, he knows who these guys are. These guys are a vicious group, a terrorist organization, and a group that is deeply despised in Iran. Now, Bolton is, you know, Bolton has this sort of pathological fixation with Iran. He sees Iran as this great threat. Now, Iran, you know, a lot of Iran's foreign policy is certainly not great. You know, they spend billions of dollars on foreign expeditions while their country is in dire economic straits. But bombing Iran is not going to solve the Iranian people's problems. Bombing Iran and invading Iran and overthrowing the regime through sort of an external intervention is going to be a lot worse than Iraq. We've seen how the United States, think of it this way. You know, many of the criticisms the neoconservatives used to put forward about Iraq and Iran, you know, they're valid criticisms that these countries are authoritarian. But these people themselves, are you really going to trust them to implement democracy in these countries? It's like Imperial Japan used to criticize Western imperialism in, you know, places like Indonesia and India, which is fair enough. But, you know, Imperial Japan, when it turned up, didn't make the situation much better. So Bolton has this long history of hostility.
Well, and especially, I mean, the United States is the primary imperial actor in the world today. So, I mean, to say the least. And, of course, the history of, you know, you just cannot, you know, discount the history of coup making on Iran. And also the fact that definitely, I mean, in addition to the success of the Iranian nuclear deal, which no one disputes that Iran was observing, that after September 11th, the Khatami government absolutely through back channels was trying to normalize relations with the United States. So in all of these realist senses, I mean, there's just absolutely no leg for the U.S. to stand on, regardless of what, yeah, I think, of course, everybody agrees are, you know, Iranian human rights abuses and so forth.
But yeah, Bolton, though, I mean, Bolton was one of those officials who was pushing for escalation with the Iranian regime. And, you know, if we remember last year, there was a war scare, but, you know, over potential bombings, over drones and things like that. And
After they assassinated Qasem, this
ongoing escalation,
right.
Bolton obviously thought that he could goad Trump into war. I think, you know, I think people like Bolton probably have the same perception of Trump as we do, where it's like, you know, if I can get in a room with him and be the last person he talks to, I can get my objectives, you know, because he is so sort of malleable in that sense. So, you know, but Trump has these anti-war, you know, anti-interventionist instincts at times. And, you know, obviously that didn't work out for John Bolton either. And, you know, if we read his book, probably there's a lot of valid criticisms and, you know, there certainly is, and he's exposing certain things, but he's salty. He's salty that he didn't get to ram through his neoconservative agenda, Iran and other countries around the world which John Bolton wants to take a more militaristic and aggressive posture towards.
Well, I want to talk about the danger of that in a second, but I mean, you know, in terms of sort of normalizing Bolton's foreign policy as, you know, people who have zero discernment, only Trump fixation, sort of embrace him. But regardless, before we get to that, I mean, what do you think are the most significant? Because even as John Bolton is a totally unreliable narrator in terms of, you know, he makes, you know, the book is also quite egotistical, according to reports, and he's got this, you know, just disgusting foreign policy. And, you know, thank God he wasn't listened to on Iran and North Korea. But at the same time, I mean, his, you know, talking about how, you know, corrupt and disgusting and self-indulgent Trump is, I mean, of course, I believe every single word of that. So what do you think the most significant things that he's written about Trump are?
Well, I am looking forward to reading to the book, although I kind of don't want to give John Bolton money for that book.
Yeah, please, God, don't buy this book, people.
Yeah, so
Don't buy the book.
I'm going to have to find some other way to get it. Get access.
Yes.
But I think, I mean,
we'll get you a review copy, TMBS contributor, MR contributor, review copy.
Ultimately, I think the revelations that John Bolton has put forward about the corruption, about the relationship with Xi, about the discourse on, for example, the Uyghurs. Firstly, it shows the utter cynicism of the way that foreign policy has been made in the Trump administration. But ultimately, I don't think it's anything that we could not have surmised or that we could not have imagined. I mean, every single book that has come out about the Trump administration has basically confirmed what everyone's perceptions were and what, what we would assume Trump would be doing, right? So it's interesting in that it kind of confirms things for us. But, you know, it's confirming things that we all probably would have assumed anyway. It's just actually seeing it and having someone who was a senior administration official confirming it sort of adds more weight to that kind of thing. And I think we'll see more and more of these kind of things coming out.
Can you talk about the Uyghur thing specifically, and maybe also go back to the banking intervention basically telling Xi, like, you know, hey, here's how you can help me get reelected.
Yeah, I mean, this is like something which is totally believable because you can imagine that Trump did this, right? You know, Trump is not some kind of person who is a big fan of human rights and who's going to shed tears about oppression. Now, what we've seen in China is, and I think the reporting is pretty strong. I want to give a shout out to my former classmate from uni, Amy Chin, who writes for the New York Times and who's written about the Uyghurs. We've seen really brutal oppression of the Uyghur community. Now, this is within the context of, you know, China attempting to consolidate power. You know, it's a very similar dynamic to what's happening in Kashmir or what Turkey's been going on or what Israel's been doing within the context of sort of gaining greater control, consolidating central authority across the thing. And this has obviously led to the creation of, you know, what seems to be concentration camps, but the Chinese.
I agree with everything you're saying, and the reporting is, I mean, look, there's no doubt that there's significant rights abuses for sure of the Uyghur community. I guess I'm going to hesitate. I mean, I don't, you know, I might want to have some precision about the use of that word, although it could be. I just think it's. The trouble with China right now is that, you know, it's 100%, again, the pioneering of abuses and surveillance systems, particularly in Tibet and the Uyghur region, are undeniable. And then at the same time, of course, this is the sort of tip of the sphere of a new sort of neocon, neoliberal aggression towards China. So that's the, you know, that's.
I mean, the term concentration camp is.
Yeah.
Is of course controversial,
but they could well be. What
is happening is there are significant numbers of Uyghurs who have been placed into, you know, prisons and who are which are being re-education camps. Are there elements that want to exaggerate the brutality of this? Probably, but you know, at the same time, the Chinese government is sort of attempting to frame job retraining program, right? Yep. So what, you know, what we have is, you know, these significant human rights abuses, which elements of the right are using as a kind of discursive tool to say how evil the Chinese government is. Now, you know, these same people don't say a word about Kashmir, which is also a pretty brutal case, but, you know, there is legitimate criticism, but again, as with many things on the political right, it's mobilized in an entirely cynical manner. But what we see is Trump actually has sympathy for this day. And no doubt, because Trump is thinking, you know, I wouldn't mind being able to put a bunch of people in a prison camp without any...
Thinking of his own concentration camps.
Yes. Yeah, you know, like, without due process. You know, Trump has proven time and time again and that he has this deep authoritarian instinct. And, you know, so him praising Xi for this, it's you know, like, he's basically telling the Chinese, all my anti-Chinese rhetoric is a big song and dance for the rubes, and I totally sympathize with you. Could you do me a favor and buy some more soybeans from swing states so that I can get my reelection? So, you know, it, on one level, it shows the cynicism of Trump's foreign policy and Trump's anti-China rhetoric in that, you know, the guy really is just using this for domestic consumption. And secondly, you know, it shows Trump once again, and I'm sure he doesn't do this consciously, is trying to get foreign powers to assist him in his election, right? Which is just, you know, I can understand why people would freak out about that, you know, but it's kind of obvious that that's going to happen, you know, what do you expect? So it's really, again, it's just nothing we wouldn't have expected. You know, do we really think Trump is upset about, you know, Muslims getting put into prisons?
Yeah,
do you think he really cares a lot about what's going on in Hong Kong? No, not really. He's more interested about American domestic affairs. He's got the, you know, whatever authoritarians do, you know, little, the only value is that it might provide a propaganda victory for him. And, you know, American foreign policy has always been cynical, but this level of cynicism sort of really takes the varnish off it and, you know, embarrasses sort of more traditional foreign policy types who at least type to keep up the pretense that there is some kind of guiding principle of human rights behind the American relationship with the rest of the world.
So do you think that this will have any political effect?
I mean... Does anything have any political effect these days? I mean, American politics is, from my perspective, is so polarized. I mean, like, I live in a very Trump era of the country. And whatever happens, you know, you have the Trump people who are not particularly switched on to politics, so they just like Trump because Trump's Trump. And then you have the more intellectual conservatives who will rationalize anything, you know. For example, the evangelicals, everything is viewed through the lens of whether they're going to get abortion outlawed or not. Right. So, you know, it's really irrelevant to them whether Trump does this or whether Trump does that, because they will always, you know, increasingly you find that the justifications they make are negative, you know, saying that the Democrats are bad rather than Trump being good. But, you know, is this going to change minds? No, what's going to happen is... Bolton's going to be canceled by the right. That's what he's going to be. He's going to be canceled by the right, and
he'll have his day on CNN and MSNBC, which is just pathetic and expected. But yes, he's not going to be on Fox. You know,
he's going to be a Morning Joe regular.
Absolutely. He'll be a Morning Joe regular. All right. So Israel has occupied the West Bank since the late '60s. Even this withdrawal from Gaza that they're always talking about is not, I mean, they control Gaza. And if anything, post-withdrawal over a decade gone, the brutality and viciousness of Israeli crimes against Gaza have increased, whether we're talking about indiscriminate bombing campaigns by, you know, Olmert or Netanyahu governments, or just the ongoing, you know, as one Israeli general said several years ago, we're going to put Gaza on a diet. They have lack of food, lack of medicine, lack of nutrition. David Cameron, former British PM, said it's an open air prison. You know, the absolute viciousness of Israeli policy is not controversial anywhere else in the world besides the United States. And frankly, becoming less so in parts of the United States as, you know, it just, the reality becomes harder and harder to deny. Now, that being said, along with that, the sort of, you know, the complexity of, you know, there's no left in Israel, really. I mean, it's a very marginalized actual peace movement. There's like a kind of genuine liberal party, Meretz, which scores very poorly. And really, the only major figure who's actually willing to criticize these policies is the former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, which sometimes he does quite effectively. So that being said, I mean, now we've somehow, I mean, Netanyahu, even under, you know, multiple very serious corruption charges. I mean, there's a lot of corruption in Israel, but some of these charges actually implicate, you know, trying to interfere with the free press, which does exist inside, you know, 67 borders. He's negotiated yet another coalition. He's neutralized another one of his primary political antagonists, though I would say, you know, Benny Gantz obviously doesn't have any substantive difference in terms of ending Israeli apartheid or the siege on Gaza or even the real democratic character of 67 borders Israel itself. So they're making it formal. They're talking about annexing the West Bank. And, you know, what, especially as people have sort of increasingly accepted the reality of what Israel is and what that situation is, and as Israel has sort of jettisoned its leadership that is concerned about, you know, what some kind of liberals tissing in the United States might think, or, you know, or what the European Union might think, you know, Netanyahu doesn't care. So where are we?
I mean, to begin with, one point that you mentioned about sort of Israel's declining sort of image in the West. One thing that Matt Dust tweeted the other day was the Democratic Majority for Israel had an advert against Jamal Bowman, who was running against Elliot Engel, who is a, you know, very pro-Israeli member of Congress. And what was striking about the advert was it made no mention of Israel. It was about Jamal Bowman apparently 20 years ago having problems paying his taxes because, you know, America is a difficult country to live in.
Right. It didn't mention Israel. It just class shamed him.
Class shamed.
It was like, hey, wow, Jamal Bowman, in addition to being a great educator, has problems that a vast majority of Americans could relate to, you know, whatever idiotic thinking that was.
Anyways, you know, one of the more insidious things I noticed, I mean, you know, it's difficult to tell people's ethnicity from the voice, but the voice it sounded like a black woman, which, you know, it just reminds me of how PR companies in Britain will have a Scot or a Northern English person do an advert because those are more trustworthy voices for the target demographics that they're hitting for. So, you know, I think we're seeing, you know, the consensus on Israel breaking down in light of what's been happening over the last 20, 30 years. You know, it becomes increasingly difficult to blame everything on Ararat when he's been dead for, you know, more than a decade and a half, right? So we've seen Israel come to this kind of difficult point, which, you know, is perhaps a point that it was always going to come to. You know, Israel has since 1967 occupied, you know, most of, you know, in fact, occupied all of this sort of historic mandate of Palestine, the West Bank. It's taken some territory from Syria, the Golan Heights, and Gaza. And it's effectively administrated them as a temporary occupation. But how long is an occupation temporary, right? You know, like this thing has gone on for generations. People born in 1967, you know, these people are getting on in age quite a bit. So we're seeing and what's happened is the possibility of a two-state solution has been increasingly undermined because Israel has followed a policy of settlement. You know, one can criticize the Palestinian movement for making political mistakes or engaging in, you know, counterproductive activities. But I'm not really interested in criticizing the Palestinians when the key poison pill that has undermined the possibility of a two-state solution has been this expansion of settlements, which went on throughout the 1990s, which was the sort of golden age of the peace process. Maybe the Palestinians should have, you know, accepted certain agreements in the past, but that's 20 years ago now. We're now living in a different era. And, you know, there are now hundreds of thousands of Israelis, Jewish Israelis, living in the West Bank. And because of the political power they possess within the Israeli electoral system, they can't be discounted. So we have this situation where you have, you know, we do comparisons with apartheid, right? Now, sometimes Americans are very, you know, loose in using sort of racial analogies that work in North America, in other parts of the world. You know, the way that boundaries are constructed within the Israel-Palestine context are not so much between black and white, but are more like a Balkan nationalism based on sectarianism and things like that. But the mechanisms that we look at, the mechanisms through which Israel is exercising control are very comparable to colonial administrations. And we've seen, you know, you can talk about South Africa, but we can talk about the United States, you know, where you have a group that is forced onto increasingly smaller parcels of land as land is sort of handed out to the dominant group, which is Israeli Jews in the Israeli context. So the material basis for a two-state solution, which may have been a possibility in the 90s, has now totally gone. And now Bibi Netanyahu, who has possessed this objective for a long time, this is not as if Bibi just came up with this. This has been, I remember reading that, you know, Bibi had a map of this some 20 years ago, had a map of the West Bank with orange parts highlighting the settlements, and his saying on this was that, you know, one day hopefully this will be all orange, right? So now, sort of the modus vivendi that's existed is that, you know, we've had this growing settlement, but these regions have not been incorporated into Israel proper. So we have this kind of limbo situation, which allows, you know, some hope that there might be, you know, illusory hope that there might be a two-state solution. Bibi now is talking about making annexations, and it's not clear if they'll do, you know, maybe they'll go ahead full ahead with this, maybe they won't, but annexing large Jordan Valley, which aren't the biggest population centers, but they contain key natural resources. Water is a precious and not only do they plan to annex these territories into Israel proper. And I'll tell you, why is this important? Well, because if you want to build in the occupied territories, there's a whole rigmarole of process that you have to go through the Ministry of Defense, through, you know, which can be slow. You annex it and Israel exercises sovereignty. These decisions are made locally, which allows quicker expansion and so on. So there's a whole bunch of things. You know, it's not like it's radically changing things on the ground, but it's formalizing a situation. It's formalizing the situation that's existed for a long time. And in addition, Israel gives citizenship to those Palestinians who live in that district as well. So it wants the land without the people, right?
Right. Well, now, and also, go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, this is again, put it in the framework of the global context. The Uyghurs, Kashmir, you know, more military action in the south of the Philippines, you know.
Right, put it Indonesia.
Indonesia, put it in context of all these. This is the a greater consolidation of power. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you go to the Israeli public, you know, like Benny Gantz, who's like, let's keep the status quo. That's not as attractive as moving forward and continuing this. Now, what I think is the byproduct of this in the long term, and, you know, I many of my Arab colleagues, are pointing out this is the death of Israel. Now, I'm not so optimistic that you were going to see like a massive and just not to be misconstrued. I don't want Israel to die per se, but
It to become maybe a full democracy for
I'd
all.
I'd like it to become a full. I don't think, you know, so I think Israel has the military power to keep this situation sustainable in the medium term. I don't think we're going to see changes in the short term, but in the long term, how sustainable is it to have this kind of situation where you have Israel effectively exercising sovereignty over this entire territory, getting in a song and dance about actually, but these regions are governed by the Palestinians, while at the same time saying, oh, but they're historically Israeli territories anyway. How long is this sustainable for? And how long will it be before the Palestinians give up on two states and start demanding civil rights? I think one of the biggest threat for Israel is not from violent Palestinian, or at least for the status quo in Israel, it's not from Palestinian violence or missiles being fired out. That's an impotent rage. The biggest threat is that the Palestinians will give up on this and begin demanding an equal seat in a unified state. And when that happens, I think we're going to see radical changes.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add to that is, and this is me being extremely pessimistic, although I think you're mostly right. One is that, you know, the apartheid analogies really start coming initially from Desmond Tutu, Ronnie Caserals, I mean, actual people who liberated South Africa. So I think that's important to remember. And of course, Nelson Mandela himself infamously saying on Ted Koppel and one of his, at the town hall in Harlem, like, we're not going to be properly free as South Africans until the Palestinians are liberated. So, and then there's also the Jim Crow analogy, which particularly when you look at different roads for settlers versus Palestinians and, this type and, police standing by while, Jewish settlers, engage in acts of vandalism and terrorism. I mean, this is very, the analogies get very, and actually, I think, another one you could do is potentially in some ways the relationship between some of the settler parties and Likud and maybe also, imperfectly, but RSS and BJP in India. So there's a lot of, and I think that's kind of the point is that, when South Africa was liberated, I mean, one, you did have, I mean, the ANC might be pound for pound the most brilliant and synthesizing liberation struggle in history, of many, particularly in Africa at that time. But the leadership and the range of strategy they put together, as well as the amount of truly exceptional leaders they had, really was just distinctive. I mean, but there was also, one, you had, and this was a very positive side of having a power balance in the world. You had the Soviets actually backing the right side in a lot of these liberation struggles, including the African National Congress, as well as, Sweden under Olof Palme. And then by the time you got to, companies like Israel or British mining companies saying, we're going to, sit down representatives from both sides at, beautiful estates in the UK and negotiate a transition, it was clear which way the world was going. And, I think the world is going in an opposite direction today. And some of the, core intellectual infrastructure of this kind of new resurgent right, this new kind of, it's still pretty pseudo-nationalism because these are still all hyper-globalized capitalist countries. But the increasing comfort with, eliminationist and bigoted policies, not a healthy call to, robust social safety nets and, sort of healthy social democratic national policies, but real, vindictive nationalism is at an ascent. And I think, Israel can look at that and say, all of these tendencies that, when Barak and Olmert said, we're going to be a pariah, well, maybe we're in a pariah world now.
I mean, I think that's, for all, and I have plenty of criticisms for the liberal world order that people harken back. But, there was at least some pretext that they wanted to, that they wouldn't go full out. One of the things that the Trump administration has done, it's basically just said, take off the gloves. It's not like these things weren't happening before. To use an analogy, the war against ISIS, the Obama administration was fighting it. There was bombing and so on. So there was the cost, but it was a much slower rate and less, brutal than when Trump came to power. And it was just like, do what you like. So now we're seeing that kind of acceleration. So of course these tendencies have existed for a while. It's not like before Modi came to power, Kashmir was the center of, peace and stability.
Most militarized place in the world.
Exactly. And now we're seeing conflict with China, you know, where Chinese and Indian soldiers are clashing with bamboo sticks and artillery on the boundary, which, you know, further destabilizes the situation. So, you know, things, you know, under the Obama administration were bad, but things can get worse, and they are getting worse. And that's something, key to understanding about the situation. We have to avoid nostalgia for a bygone era, which was never as great as people sort of want to make out to it. But let's also, as you say, let's avoid false equivalencies. You know, yes, there's corruption. You know, Hillary Clinton, you know, the Saudis weren't giving Hillary Clinton money because they cared about Haitian children. But, you know, that is a different thing from, you know, some of the naked transactionalism that is taking place now.
I honestly have to say, I don't, you know, in the Clintons' case, the Clintons get pretty damn close. But certainly, you know, I mean, the simplest one really is, I mean, the Obama administration, absolute height of neoliberal decadence and corruption through the formal channels. But in terms of the very naked give and take of Trump, actually night and day, in a way that the Clintons, I would say, are not, frankly. I mean, there's a lot of conspiracy theories about the Clintons and everything else, but they were much closer to that line than Obama was.
Well, one of the things I think upsets people in DC, and this is just my personal take, is that Trump is kind of ruining the party because they were all able to do their corruption, not corruption, perfectly legally, right? Perfectly legally. Now Trump is like a bull in the china shop, doing things which is bringing light to this kind of thing and kind of ruining the party for everybody, because people are, you know, when Trump gets criticized, he often will, his followers in the media will often raise legitimate points about, well, you know, you're complaining about this. Why weren't you complaining about it when this Obama administration official did this, or when Hillary Clinton did that, and so on and so forth? So I think, you know, part of it is because Trump is bad at doing the traditional corruption that DC is so used to and DC operates upon.
Absolutely. Well, Gene Bajelan, as always, appreciate your time, brother. Stay safe, stay strong. Best wishes to everybody.
Hey, you take care of yourself and have a wonderful day.
Thank you. All right, folks, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show is possible. Become a member of the Michael Brooks Show, patreon.com/TMBS. You can watch the full Noam Chomsky interview that way, as well as the conversations, Cornel West, Adolf Reed, Slavoj Žižek, President Lula, so many more. Incredibly proud. And we also, I should say, in the last episode, in addition to Noam Chomsky, had a great conversation with Medina Torre. She's a reporter covering education in New York City for Politico. And we talked about the actual mechanics of how you redirect NYPD funding, primarily in this case, to education, and the role of students in the movement in New York City. It was a great conversation. And, you know, get the post games, get the illicit histories. There's just a huge amount of content there. We're really proud of it. We're also going to have a new store ready soon with a new wave of shirts and hats and stuff. We sold out our last supply. We're getting ready to gear up to go with more union made stuff. And you can also, I'll say this one, go subscribe to the Jacobin YouTube channel. There's an amazing stay at home series with seminars and lectures from, you know, Gerald Horn and Bill Fletcher Jr. and Adolf Reed, and a great conversation yesterday with Ben Fong, Amber Lee, and Matt Chrisman, Amber Lee Frost. And Saturdays, Anna Kasperi and I host Weekends, which is a really, really fun show. And we had Shama Sawant on. She was great. She's really putting in serious points on the board in Seattle. So go subscribe to Jacobin YouTube channel and watch Weekends with me and Anna, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, patreon.com/TMBS. And of course, go buy Against the Web, Cosmopolitan Answer to the New Right at your favorite independent bookseller. Matt, what's going on? Or at Red Emma's in Baltimore. Matt, what's cooking?
Yeah, twitch.tv/literary hangover. I'm going to be doing more on James Fenimore Cooper's The Pilot, the first C novel. And, yeah, talking about John Paul Jones and things like that. So check that out, folks.
John Paul Jones. things like that. Tremendous stuff. Okay, Jamie has arrived. Jamie, what's cooking?
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yeah, can hear you all now. Right. And cool. See you.
Cool. So this week on the Antifada, we had a little multi-segment episode, NPR style. So first we had Andy speaking with Alex Edward, who is co-host of the podcast Minion Death Cult, very funny podcast about cursed boomer media and social media posts, basically. He is also a Seattle resident, and he lives a couple blocks from the Chaz or the Chop or the Soviet Union or whatever folks are calling it these days. He gave us a little report on what it's like there, what's happening on the ground, and a little bit of discussion about that. Also, I spoke with Matt Marciniak of the Mutual Aid Project in Minneapolis, Justice Frontline Aid. It went a little bit viral. Someone made a post about how they were distributing in the Target parking lot goods that may or may not have been liberated to the people who need them. So we talked about that. And then Sean and I wrapped it up with some commentary. So that's out now for everybody to listen to who wants to. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Jamie, I think you might want to check which mic you have selected. I think it's your computer mic and not your...
Yeah, I think you guys are right.
Okay. My bad.
Yeah, give that a check. But you could do that because we're about to take a break and we will see everybody in the fun half.
All right.
Oh, you're good now.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up the buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.